Mother has been very often.
In Buchenwald.
In Buchenwald.
This is the story of a small town in Germany, of a concentration camp on a hill nearby, and an oak tree. Weimar is the town where Goethe and Schiller and their contemporaries wrote a new kind of German identity at the start of the 19th century. Buchenwald, the camp where the Nazis murdered 56,000 men, women and children, and the tree, the only tree that the SS allowed to stand in the middle of their camp, that's Goethe's oak.
An unusual oak, almost a cross, with rusted hooks which carried people like acorns in full bloom. The oak is ashamed today that it grows from the same ground as the power of the spirit and the arrogance of the henchmen.
Did you hear the story that says something about an oak, a Goethe's oak somewhere?
Oh, of course.
Well, the legend is that Goethe supposedly wrote to somebody that as long as this oak stands, Germany will stand.
By the time we arrived in the camp, the Goethe oak was no longer living. It was a memento of a remote past.
Sitting under this house, Goethe is supposed to have written the poem Über allen Wipfeln des Ruhe.
That is, that was Über alle
Wipfeln des Ruhe is one of the most.
Über allen Wipfeln des
Over all the peaks, there's peace. In all these trees, you feel no breath of breeze. The woodland birds, their sounds have ceased. Hush, for soon you'll be yourself at peace.
Goethe's famous poem is Wanderer's Nachtlied, the Wanderer's Night Song. Very often, very, very often, we thought of that poem. Not only Goethe, but we discussed Goethe, Schiller, German music. We hadn't lost our respect for the German past, but it was always weighed down by the dreariness of the present.
This is platform number 3 at Weimar railway station. On this and the other platforms on this neat, tidy station, from 1938, the other Germany dismounted from trains and was taken away to a new camp that had been built up in the woods outside Weimar.
The train halted briefly in a station. Somewhere a bell was ringing, and from a distance a voice could be heard calling, "Ja, hier Weimar!" Sirens wailed through the empty streets. I could see a strange procession winding its way through one of the turnings. Armed children, marching in black uniforms. They must have been about 14 or 15 years old. They were singing a song as chill as the wind howling above the streets. Through the iron grille of the window of the truck, I watched this fearful march past. Curious eyes peered from the windows of houses near to the station. I noticed a woman clutching a baby in her arms. The train jerked on.
Communists, social democrats, Christians who had fallen foul of the Nazi regime. There were also quite a number of Jews, more than is often realised, even at that time. And the Nazis had carried out this Werkschei Reich campaign, and in the course of that they'd arrested quite a number of people that they didn't like for various reasons, including so-called vagrants. There were also those who had been in prisons, and rather than be released into the community, they were then brought to Buchenwald. So it was a motley community, but a lot of them certainly were political prisoners in those early days.
Oh, Buchenwald, ich kann dich nicht vergessen, weil du mein Schicksal bist.
The concentration camps had this, at least in the 30s, this circulating population who were treated for their politics, who were treated for their alcoholism, and who would then be released into the society as cured, is something that is part and parcel of the ideology behind Buchenwald.
Sandra Gilman.
Isolation is part of cure. Isolation, of course, is also part of making these camps relatively invisible.
The prisoners would have been driven off the platform, down the steps into this tunnel that runs underneath the whole station. And there, from 1938 too, they would be joined by another group of prisoners, because 1938 was the year of the pogroms against the Jewish Germans. It was the year of Kristallnacht.
But starting in the 30s, the number of deaths in these camps increases exponentially over time.
As they reached the end of this tunnel under the platforms, they would have seen before them one of the most perfect and one of the most beautiful of all German small towns. A town that was home to Goethe, home to Schiller, to the great humanist tradition at the end of the 17th and 18th century.
Prisoners who would arrive at the train station would not go through the city. Therefore, some people say, well, we did not notice. Might be true. We have also a report of one man who said, don't believe these arguments. We, as a school class, were forced by our teacher to go over to the train station as a whole collection of prisoners arrived, and our teacher wanted to show us how they looked like and even support us in throwing stones at them. The key question is not knowledge, but feeling responsibility. If you don't feel responsible, you would not listen to information which might disturb you.
Ich bin des Treibens müde.
Many of the prisoners from Buchenwald, on work detail here in Weimar or marched up the steep hill to the camp beyond it, would have known that this was Goethe's town. But Goethe's house here in the centre was not for them. Verbrecher, criminals, socialists, communists and Jews, enemies of the Nazi state. Not for the first time, Goethe had been borrowed by those in power for their own ideological purposes.
Everything inside is original, including the colours of the walls. That's why, of course, we always tell people not to lean up against the walls or don't sit on the furniture. But it's just such a phenomenon to have the dining room table, the chairs, everything that he personally chose for this house. And he lived here for 40 years, having moved in here in 1792, and dying in 1832 in his 83rd year. It's just permeated with his spirit and his taste.
The house is anything but triumphant. It's admirably modest for a man who was the greatest German writer of the age, a notable scientist too. Here, Goethe, with the dramatist Schiller and others, consciously set out to create a German humanism that would counter the new radical politics of the French Revolution. Helmut Lehmann is the president of the Weimar Classic Stiftung.
Goethe gave them a new language. You have to see that. It was a new German language the classics gave to the German-speaking cultures. And it was not a nation. It was a nation only in a sense of culture, not in a sense of state.
We don't have a political unity. We are not as industrialized as Britain. We don't have the cultural nous of the French even now.
Dr. Laura Martin is senior lecturer in comparative literature at the University of Glasgow.
But we're becoming the great scientist. We've written all the music. We've done the deepest philosophy. We're the deep ones. I think that's the sense that the Germans have at that time.
There is a very typical color in the German culture, but all these protagonists of the classical period were completely aware what is going on culturally in France, in England, in Italy. Compare this situation with a situation where culture is something to make a borderline. I do not see that he could be the godfather of a special German way.
If Goethe stood aloof from the notion that the Germans were different, special even, where and when does that idea take root?
This argument of the Sonderweg, that certainly is there in the middle of the 19th century, that Germans themselves are saying, we don't have political power, but we do have cultural power, and that can console us. So by the end of the 19th century, and certainly at the beginning of the 20th century, Goethe stands for German poetry, German letters, and he stands for humaneness and humanity as the thing that Germans do. And this seems quite odd because they mix this in with German militarism, which is a very, very different thing.
Weimar and the region of Thuringia had developed a taste for firm political authority before the Nazi Party hijacked the German Republic in 1933. Local Nazis, led by Wilhelm Frick, had already joined a coalition government in Thuringia in 1929. Adolf Hitler visited the town on more than 40 separate occasions. Yet this is still Goethe's town, the cradle of a German identity, even if that identity was constantly shifting. It had lent its name to the Constitution of the German Republic that came into being after the defeat of the First World War. It was home to the German National Theatre and an important place for the discerning cultural tourist.
Weimar had been a touristic place even before, thanks to Goethe and Schiller, where retired people would love to live and enjoy theatre and so on.
Daniel Gader is head of the education department at the Buchenwald Memorial Site.
That explains also why anti-modernist movements, anti-Semitic people, anti-democrats would gather here in Weimar. So traditions of against this new republican and democratic system would be pretty strong in Weimar. The Nazi youth movement, Hitlerjugend, was established here. In terms of voting, there were more than 50% voting for the Nazi party.
The Nazis had a very big interest in the classic literature, but they selected in an extreme way. So you had the Faust is the German individual, interpreted in a sense of a man of acting without moral barriers. That is one side of the Faust concept, but only one.
They were easier with Schiller because Schiller was regarded as kind of heroic, very dramatic poet. He was seen as a revolutionary, but as a national revolutionary initially, which Goethe wasn't.
Bill Niven, professor of contemporary German history at Nottingham University.
On the other hand, of course, the Nazis also had some problems with Schiller, especially in 1941, I think, Hitler decided to ban performances of William Tell because William Tell's murder of Gessler was seen as encouraging people to tyrannicide, which is not really what you wanted in 1941. Goethe was too much of a world citizen, and he was perhaps too classical too for the Nazis, I think.
But if Goethe was a classicist, he was also a fellow traveller with Romanticism, with gothic ballads like Der Erlkönig, where a father loses his son on a dark night to a honey-tongued demon.
Who rides so boldly through night and wind? Goethe is part of a romantic memorialization of the forest as places of testing, as places of beauty. The brothers Grimm tell the stories, of course, of Hänsel and Gretel. Forests are those spaces where real Germany, scary Germany sometimes, right? The Erl King, scary Germany, but where danger is overcome. Romantic forests are places of testing.
Goethe says whoever walks his whole life under serious or earnest oak trees would have to become a different kind of person than somebody who every day walks under airy birch trees. What is that about? He goes on to say that he finds that each country, each folk, each people has chosen in the ancient times, chosen their place to live by having some sort of unity with the natural setting that they're in. So he sees a kind of a back and forth about humans construct the natural environment. The natural environment also, very importantly, constructs a human being. You're a different person if you walk under serious, earnest oak trees. The oak tree is very important in a lot of mythologies, including Teutonic mythology, but also goes back to classical times. It's strong, it's mighty, it also tends to attract the lightning bolts.
On the Ettersberg, there stood a large oak tree, a Große Eiche, a fat oak. Here, said the legend, sat Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, but he didn't. There's no evidence that he lingered under this tree with his inspiration, Charlotte von Stein, and besides, the tree that sheltered them was a beech. Nevertheless, Goethe's oak became a must-see for literary tourists to Weimar from the middle of the 19th century. The Nazis, too, loved oak trees. They added oak leaves to Germany's highest military award, the Iron Cross, and Hitler, it said, regularly planted young oaks, one on the German frontier on the eve of the Second World War. 2 years before, what we might think of as a dark version of Weimar was taking shape amongst the oaks and the beech trees, amongst the Eichen and die Buchen on the slopes of the Ettersberg. A school to train the SS, a concentration camp for criminals and political prisoners, to be called Konzentrationslager Ettersberg. Bill Niven.
Because Ettersberg's associated with Goethe and Charlotte von Stein, particularly the word Ettersberg, the National Socialist Cultural Community in Weimar said it would be inappropriate to name a concentration camp after a place that was so associated with Goethe. It was decided to call it Buchenwald.
That is very typical for the German situation in the 30s. There is something which is of high value and we have to protect it against everybody, but we cannot use it. Humanity is something for literature and nothing for the political reality.
When they succeeded in getting enough of an area for the camp, they brought in prisoners from Sachsenhausen, which already existed, and the prisoners were asked to chop these trees down. So one of the most horrible experiences for them was arriving and being told to go about this physical labour of chopping down enormous numbers of trees. And the mud and the dirt and the filth, it's a pretty awful experience. Prisoners were asked not to touch the oak. That was to be protected. It was sacrosanct.
The trees on the crest of the Ettersberg dripped with wet and stretched up motionlessly into the silence that wrapped the hill and separated it from the surrounding landscape. Leaves washed out and exhausted by the winter were decaying on the ground in a gleam of moisture. Signs placed between the trees seemed to be threatening it. Area headquarters. Concentration camp Buchenwald. Danger. Keep out. Trespassers will be shot without warning.
High above Weimar is a former royal hunting lodge, Schloss Ettersberg, an elegant 18th-century cream-painted building where Goethe's patron, Duke Karl August, would entertain the literary talent that he and his mother had drawn to Weimar. Goethe and the poet Wieland, and Schiller too. In front of the castle, leading along the ridge of the Ettersberg, they've cut a Zeitschneise, literally a cut in time. You begin to realise that the history that you thought you were tracing is not one, but several histories, and that they rarely weave themselves together into a perfect pattern.
These poles represent the grave sites of victims of Special Camp Number 2.
This is the camp that was created by the Soviet authorities after 45.
Exactly, yes.
Walking this twisting time way with me is Becky Reitz. She works in the education department of the Buchenwald Memorial Site.
They were trying to imprison former Nazi offenders in the camp, but there was no real court proceedings that went along with that. Basically, it would be enough if somebody just pointed someone out and said he was active in the Nazi party. That would be reason for them to be imprisoned in the internment camp. They could find someone's name on a document without looking further into it, and that would also be justification for them to be imprisoned in the internment camp.
Before we've even reached the main site at Buchenwald, the history that we thought we knew has changed its story. A Nazi concentration camp becomes an outpost of the Gulag.
There are about 28,000 imprisoned over the period of 4 years, and about 7,000 of those died, about 25%.
Were they also murdered in the same way that the Nazis had murdered prisoners?
No, there was no execution, there was no torture, there was no forced labour. It was just very, very bad conditions. This all happened between 1945 and 1949.
When did they want to, as it were, reclaim this bit of history?
This part of the memorial site was put in after 1989, after the reunification of Germany. They knew just from prisoners in the camp and just various witnesses that people had been buried in this area or even just thrown in this area. And each of the poles represents a place where they found remains of somebody.
As you come out of the woods to a huge marshalling yards here, there's a large rock set down on the edge on which there is stenciled a particular image. It's of a cattle truck, and behind it, bars of a jail, of a prison, and beyond that, the blue of a blue sky. And then you look away from that image, and behind you see the woods stretching away, the wild spring flowers, white and yellow, and beyond the new greening trees. And it's the incongruity of nature renewing itself with a sense of death that's encapsulated in that little stencil on the rock.
They started building a railway from the main train station in Weimar up to Buchenwald, and they started building that in 1943. They were originally given only 6 months to build this 4-kilometer tract of railway line. It ended up taking them about a year to build this, and the railway was first used end of 1943, beginning of 1944. And where we're standing right now are the remains of this railway line.
They went from Weimar town, the railway station where we began our journey, right the way up here to the camp.
Because the numbers were increasing, the sheer volume of prisoners was overwhelming. Between January and April of 1945 alone, there were 5,000 prisoners arriving to the camp on a daily basis as camps were being evacuated in the east. So it was absolutely necessary to have this railway line. Not to mention there was a giant armament factory that was constructed here. They needed the railway line to transport goods and stuff up here.
On the station platform, illuminated by the searchlights, a long line of SS is waiting. They're motionless as statues, their faces concealed by the shadow of their helmets, which gleam beneath the electric lights. They're holding dogs on leashes. They know that their masters are going to let them charge at these shadows scheduled to emerge from the closed silent cars. But the SS are motionless as statues. Time passes. The dogs stop barking and lie down at the feet of the SS, growling, their backs bristling. Behind them, in the sheet of light from the searchlights, the tall trees tremble beneath the snow. Somewhere a curt order breaks the silence, and from all directions the noise of whistles rends the air. With one mechanical movement, the row of SS approaches the car. The SS begin to howl as well. The eternal cry, "Los! Los! Los!" The well-polished, ritual-like mechanism, repeated 1,000 times, strikes one immediately. Its doctored, Wagnerian aspect.
Becky, we've arrived at Buchenwald, Buchenwald in the 21st century. There's a paved road that leads right in. What's the road called?
This road is called the Karachovic, a Spanish word, and in Spanish it means damnation, or awful. It's used as an exclamation, but German takes the colloquialism of the Spanish word, and it means a very fast speed. And this was the main road going into the camp. The SS officers used to force the prisoners to run, and the SS officers would stand on either sides of the road. They would beat them with sticks. They would set attack dogs upon them. Sometimes members of the Hitler Youth Group would be invited to come up here. They would spit on the prisoners, yell racial slurs, and this was all a process of breaking them into the camp, so to speak.
And the entrance of the camp would be beyond, just where we can see over there, where the first wire is?
The main gate lays right ahead.
It was pitch dark, and I don't think that there was any starlight or any moonlight at the time.
One young man imprisoned in Buchenwald in the 1940s was Reidar Dittmann, a member of the Norwegian resistance who the SS hoped to re-educate into their version of being an Aryan.
It was very bleak, very wintry. As we finally got our clothing on, we got into our barrack, which was lit up by a very dim blue light. Otherwise, the entire camp laid there in deep darkness, looking more like a large cemetery than any other place.
I've walked up from the railway past the SS barracks, and we've now arrived at the entrance of the camp itself, and I'm joined by Daniel Gaeder, who's in charge of education here at Buchenwald. Daniel, the prisoners would have not so much marched as been driven along the journey I've made, and what would have happened when they got to this gate?
Even before they would reach the gate, they would be told very brutally that they have nothing good to expect. They would receive a number, a coloured triangle for their clothes, marking them as political, Jewish or whatever. And from the very first moment, they would also experience that prisoners would also deal with them in a harsh way. So they should not expect solidarity. So the main gate was a borderline between the world outside and inside, but not as a clear cut between these two worlds, because the majority of the prisoners had to work outside of the camp, in a quarry, or in factories during the wartime, so they kept being visible for the surrounding people.
The thing that strikes you standing outside the gate is how modest the building is. And although to the right you can see the familiar concrete posts looking like question marks with the barbed wire and with the lights on it, there's something rather almost domestic. It isn't a great kind of imposing entrance to a camp, is it?
Yeah, it's in the middle of a forest. There's no great square in front of this main gate, so you're somehow bumping into it. The message is clear. You have a clock on top and everything has to be done in time. The left wing of the main gate is a prison, in a camp saying that if there's anything that is not liked by the SS, you can be arrested for that, tortured and even killed.
It doesn't, as in so many of the other camps, say so you can read Arbeit macht frei.
It's a different text here. It says, jedem das seine in German, each for his own in English. A quotation from the Roman law, which positively should say, enjoy your life, enjoy your property, and everyone shall have that chance. Over here it was meant in this very cynical way, what you suffer here is what you deserve. Why were you born Jewish or became a communist, whatever?
Reveille started at 5 o'clock in the morning. 5:30 we would go to the kitchen area to pick up the food for the day, which consisted of rutabaga soup and dark bread and a pat of margarine. That was for the entire day. Then for the prisoners at large, and we were not prisoners at large, we were kept in a separate compound, they would march to the roll call area and be counted. And this sometimes was a very trying activity that might end up very disastrously. There were also occasionally at the roll call, there were hangings, other brutalities happening. But we were not part of that because we were saved as future potential SS members.
Nothing visible is left because the places where the barracks stood at that time are just marked with black stones. And half of the former campsite further down is overgrown with trees.
From the roll call area, the roads extended down into the camp in a sort of a fan-like way. The road to the right went into the administrative area. On the right side was also the crematorium. A little bit farther down from the crematorium was the kitchen area, and in front of that area rose the Goethe Oak. I always heard the phrase, "Hier ruhte Goethe auf seine Wanderungen in diesem Walde." Here Goethe rested on his wanderings in this forest. You could look out over the valley below. Must in its days have harbored a great many birds. We never heard any bird at all except once in the early spring of 1944. I can remember hearing the cuckoo.
The farmers from the next village, less than 2 miles away, would walk there and work there, and one of the survivors, Jorge Sempun from Spain, described like he would walk on a Sunday, sometimes down there, alongside of the fence and see farmers on the other side taking their Sunday walk.
No one has written so thoughtfully about Buchenwald than Jorge Sempun. A communist exile from Franco-Spain, Sempun joined the Maquis, was arrested by the Gestapo in 1943 and sent to Buchenwald.
A Sunday. At the end of the long, snow-covered avenue stood the monumental gates of the camp, surmounted by the watchtower. I'm walking in the sun. I feel a sort of dizziness in the pale sunlight of this winter dream. It's not disturbing. It's not even unpleasant. It is simply that there is no longer any criterion for reality. Goethe might appear at the end of the avenue with his faithful friend, Eckermann. Oh, wasn't this their favourite walk? Goethe and Eckermann on the avenue bordered with granite columns crowned by heraldic eagles. Today, Eckermann might write later, despite the cold, Goethe expressed a wish to walk on the Ettersberg, saying to me, "The observation of nature in winter will surely provide us a subject for conversation." Without further delay, I ordered the sleigh, smothered in a mountain of firs, up the Ettersberg, that fine hill, unfortunately so spoiled by the building of a corrective labour camp, in which criminals of several nationalities are confined.
We were all university students in our group. There were 349 of us. We lost 25, by the way, of those. But we had many literary discussions. We tried to stay intellectually alive. Certainly Goethe was a topic that we discussed very frequently.
I stand there, motionless in the cold sunlight of this December Sunday, dreaming that Goethe and Eckermann have appeared at the end of the avenue flanked by Nazi eagles. The Grand Duke Charles Augustus organized a hunting party here in honor of Napoleon. He is supposed to have addressed to Goethe those famous words, "Destiny is politics."
The Goethe oak was bone grey, skeletal, very, very smooth bark on it. No leaves at all, impressive in its size, and of course in its relationship to Goethe and the bestiality of the Third Reich, the meeting of the Third Reich with the glory of the German past was very significant and very disturbing.
By cutting down all the other trees, the level of groundwater would go down. So the roots of the tree would not reach any more water. So he died from missing water, and that's the reason why he has no leaves anymore.
Should we walk around and look at what all the remains of Goethe's oak, which is just the stump?
An unusual oak, almost a cross, with rusted hooks which carried people like acorns in full bloom.
They'd used the tree for punishment, they hung people up from it. Certainly before 1942 they had this notorious practice of hanging bodies from trees with their arms behind their heads, and they used the very strong boughs of the oak tree to do that, at least certainly in 37-38. From that point of view, I think the oak was from a very early point associated with torture and punishment and pain and death.
The oak is ashamed today that it grows from the same ground as the power of the spirit and the arrogance of the henchman.
If anybody had deliberately stopped under the oak to sit and try to gain some shade in the summer, I'm sure he would have been shooed away by either the SS if they were there or by the prisoner group that was in charge. We were ruled basically by the organization of the prisoners, a communist group. We had a block älteste, which means a senior inmate who took care of our particular barrack, and he was very kind to us, particularly after he realized that we were not supposed to be standard prisoners, but were under sort of special protection of the SS, which had hoped that in the course of time we would turn our hearts toward the German cause, which was, of course, an absurd thought on their part, but they were not particularly bright anyway.
Ernst Wiechert, who was a German writer, was brought to the camp because he protested against the arrest of Pastor Niemöller, and he often used to go to the oak and sit under it, principally because he said he could be alone and he could meditate, but also because it made him aware that the humanist tradition was still there. In a sense, Goethe was in the concentration camp with them. That's how he saw it. So we're together, we're facing this together, and gain some sort of solace for his time in Buchenwald and some belief that humanism perhaps hadn't gone completely and there was something worth living for.
Thou that from the heavens art, every pain and sorrow stillest, and the doubly wretched heart doubly with refreshment fillest, I am weary with contending. Why this rapture and unrest? Peace descending, come, ah, come into my breast.
By 1944, the camp at Buchenwald had become the centre of a vast industrial complex with slave labour driven to death to produce armaments. So the Allies began to bomb the armaments factories.
All right, let's fish out another episode.
The August 24th, Buchenwald was bombed by American airplane, and the bombing was made excellent.
Otto Feuer, a former Buchenwald inmate interviewed by Dr. David Boder about life in the camp in 1946.
Goethe's oak was the only victim of the bombing, very much damaged, and had to be cut.
Who cut the oak?
Prisoners cut the oak.
And David Boder also interviewed Jacques Bramson, a prisoner in Buchenwald that August day when Goethe's oak went up in flames.
There's a legend. Not only a legend, a letter which Goethe wrote to one of his friends. When I am in a sad mood, I go up to Buchenwald. I approach my oak and look at it and hope returns to me. To me, it is an embodiment of the might of our people. As long as the oak stands, the German people will also stand. And so all were waiting impatiently for the end of this oak, because this legend was so widely circulated in the camp. Since it was half burned down, and since it managed to fall against the kitchen, the commandant called over the loudspeakers for volunteers who would wish to come and chop down this tree. And a regular onslaught was waged against this tree. And within 2 minutes of the announcement, they chopped down this oak.
It seems to me to be reminiscent of the world ash and the story you get in Wagner's Ring. And I'm not quite sure if there's been a kind of conflation of those two motifs, but it's quite possible.
You found here on the oak a drawing with some text on it.
A sheet of paper left here, wet from the rain and dirty already from the stones around here. no signature, a pencil drawing of the tree. Die Goethe-Eiche, eine Pflanze. Ah, it's hard to read. So the person who wrote it and made the drawing refers directly to the tree
and those who suffered here.
And that this tree was cut down and destroyed, like the lives of so many, many prisoners here. So there's the direct connection between the fate of the tree and the fate of the prisoners, which is not quite correct referring to the actual historical facts. It was not done by the SS because they wanted to, but because the tree was already dead and then set on fire. It's a sign for this visitor that for him or for her, it is very important to see a connection between that symbol, one hand, and also the reference to the fate of the prisoners here.
But this oak and those who suffered and died by it have a more tangible memorial. Der letzte Geschichte is an impassive face and a relief. There's a hint of expressionism about this dark wood carving, the face elongated in its suffering. Carved by the artist and writer Bruno Apitz.
By order of the fascist camp command, the tree was felled and sawed for firewood in the woodyard. I obtained a piece of the wood and hid it in the barrack of my detachment, at the time the pathology facility.
We're standing by the crematorium, no more than perhaps 50 yards from the perimeter of the camp from the barbed wire. How was it that Bruno Apitz worked here? What was he doing?
He was one of those prisoners who had to work in the so-called pathology. According to law, it had to be checked why a person died. In fact, they would write fantasy reasons. Instead, they would look what is still usable from a human body in terms of medical research or just also for decorating a lampshade with human skin and tattoos. And the room was also decorated with death masks. He had the idea that a part of the tree should be used to make a sculpture of, as he called it, the last face.
Well, that was quite risky. For if I'd been caught, I inevitably would have gone up. That would have meant the bunker and death.
As you can hear from the acoustics, it's a room which should be kept clean all the time. The table in the middle was built that way that you easily can lay down a corpse and work with it. Because it was also an isolated place within the camp, doing secret artwork against the rules needed some reliable people around him. So that's the reason why he would be doing this type of work here.
As I worked, an inmate stood beside me and swept up the sawdust as it fell, whilst others were constantly in readiness to hide the piece of wood and the tools immediately in the event of danger. My haste is apparent in the coarse cut. From the many faces of our dead, a single one emerged, which I called the last face.
It also describes the different function of art in that moment. It's not just done to keep in mind one person. It's also describing the fate of many.
The notion that out of this comes a sculpture which memorializes suffering is, to use a word which is not far from my lips, but would have been very far from Apitz's lips, very Wagnerian. I mean, it really is very Wagnerian.
Sander Gilman again. The original, The Last Face, is in Berlin. The carving in the Museum at Buchenwald is a copy. And like the tree from which it was carved, it seems charged with different meanings. Daniel Gader.
The idea of the Nazis, it is not necessary at all to keep individual impressions of a person because they are not accepted as persons, is contradicted here through artwork.
I wonder also if the fact that it's made out of a piece of wood retrieved from the Goethe oak, in a sense, forges a direct link between the new regime in the German Democratic Republic and that tradition of Goethe and the kind of classical Weimar period.
Exactly, in this attempt to show socialist society is not coming from nowhere, but it is rooted also in deep humanistic ideas, how they were presented also in Weimar. Of course, there's always the attempt to explain that you have deep roots in a special type of culture, like the Nazis did also. So the question is also how the old masters are abused again for political purposes.
Bruno Apitz's other legacy is his hugely popular novel, Naked Among Wolves, the story of how a child is saved by communist prisoners in Buchenwald that became compulsory reading for all school children in East Germany and was later filmed. The communists, who had established a shadow administration within Buchenwald with the permission of the SS, also planned an armed uprising against their oppressors. And everything in the novel, Naked Among Wolves, and the film too, leads to this moment on the 11th of April 1944. Just before the American army arrived to liberate the camp, the communists rush the guard towers and break open the camp gates. It seems likely that this uprising is another contested event, like the story of Goethe's Oak. The uprising is a history that was carefully shaped by the German Democratic Republic, memorialized in song and in stone and bronze too.
The legacy of those who fought in the camp should be continued and taken over by the next generations. Therefore, this whole monument was established like a long path where on the way, on huge stone pictures, the story of the camp, of the growing resistance on one hand and the brutality on the other, would be the main theme. The way goes down the hill to three mass graves. These three graves are connected with the Street of Nations. And then you go up a long stairs and you look first into the sky. Then you see a huge bell tower. And then in front of that, a group of figures, small when you come up the hill and huge when you're standing beside them, like a group of survivors, a Frenchman, a Russian one, a child. And if you stand then on the other side, you still have the landscape in front of you, but then the survivors in your back. It's like you should find a path in your way and engage in that society in a way that will be satisfying for them.
So Buchenwald became a communist story, a founding myth for the German Democratic Republic once the regime finally closed the gates on the last political prisoners in 1949. And Goethe's Oak?
All that was left of the Goethe Oak after 1945, after it had been burnt down and cut to firewood, was a stump. It became rather overgrown, I think, when the Soviets used the camp. And then in the mid-1950s, it was freed of the greenery that had grown up around it and created as a memorial point within the site. And that's the moment, too, where Buchenwald Memorial Site asked for photographs of the tree, which they could somehow use at the memorial site, and were told by the Goethe Society in Weimar that we didn't have any of these photos, and surely you mean the Goethe beech tree, not the Goethe oak. But as of the mid-1950s, it became a point of memory in the camp and a point of memory in the guided tour. The children generally concluded their tour at this particular stump. It was associated with the resistance. It was claimed that the resistance movement had met under the tree before it was chopped down. That may well be true. They also met in the latrines, of course, but that's not something they talk about so much. They were very much fixed on this idea that the oak, because it was associated with Goethe and was associated with communist resistance, created a link between the humanism of Weimar classicism and the humanism of anti-fascism. I think that the oak was a very, very central symbol for that link.
So what does this vast site mean now that the German Democratic Republic itself has also receded into history? It's not the whole history, but like Goethe's Oak, just a single chapter. Now just one of three sites within the complex that is the Buchenwald Memorial Site on a hill above a town where once an oak tree stood. Süßer Friede, komm auch, komm in meine.
Goethe's Oak was presented by Christopher Cook. The readers were Johan Meredith and Michael Shelford. Archive was courtesy of the Voices of the Holocaust Project, and the producer was Mark Berman.